You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore, here again with Massachusetts poet Leslea Newman. As mentioned in the last segment, Leslea has written, I Wish My Father, a series of poems about the career of her life and her mother's life too, during the last years of her father's waning, in which Leslea was the great help in the household, unfortunately having to watch her father's gradual slipping in mental cognizance of the life that he once lived so vibrantly. And so what we're going to do today Leslea is going to read a large number of these poems. There are some of them long, page or two or three pages long. And so I'm going to allow Leslea to perform at some length so you can hear as we go on this very, very sad and grievous career that Leslea not only saw, perceived close up, but was able to record in her refined verse and verse forms. Welcome back to Sound Poetry, Leslea.
Thank you for having me here again.
It's great that you could be here for so long on a weekday. Thank you. So we're going to read from I Wish My Father, which as a poem I believe was I Wish My Father Happy Birthday, but we don't have that poem for one of these poems. Is that right? You didn't choose that one.
No, I actually decided that since I read the title poem from I Carry My Mother, I should probably read the title poem from I Wish My Father.
Let's do that. Good. Start with that one.
My mother died in 2012. My father died in 2017. They had been high school sweethearts and they had been together for over 63 years. So he was completely lost without her, completely. And they had a very traditional marriage. They got married in 1949. You know, my mom stayed at home and my dad went off to work. My mother did, you know, all the household tasks. So my father did not know how to do laundry. He did, the only thing he could cook were scrambled eggs. After my mother died, I came to spend a lot of time with him in New York, to settle him, take care of him, hire people to do what needed to be done. And he was still a practicing attorney at this time. He was 85. And he started having little episodes. They weren't exactly strokes, but they were episodes that compromised his mental acuity. And those got worse and worse, and they were very painful to witness. They were very confusing for him. They were very frightening for him. My mother's illness was all completely physical, and my father's illness was all cerebral. He played tennis until he was 88 years old. I mean, he was in tip-top physical shape. So my parents' illnesses were very different, and their care was very different, especially because my mother still had my father, and my father did not have my mother at the end of his life. So I will start off with the first two poems. But before I read them, I just want to explain the form. All these poems are written in the same form, in that the title also functions as the first line of the poem, and then the title goes right into the poem, and the poem consists completely of three-line stanzas. And their narrative verse. So each poem tells a story and the entire collection tells a story. When my father wakes up on that first sweltering night of that first scalding summer, soaked in sweat like my mother when she suffered those terrible hot flashes 40 years ago, he stumbles out of bed and lumbers to the archaic air conditioner, fumbling for the right button to bring it back to life with a wheeze and a groan and a thump. Next, he shuffles across the faded carpet, slides between the worn sheets, and lifts the torn blanket to cover my mother, who will surely grow stiff from the frigid air blowing between them as she had for more than 60 years. Who could blame him for forgetting she had left him and was now slumbering on the other side of town, wrapped in a shroud beneath the stony, stubborn ground? How he missed her old, cold shoulder. Yes, we have no bananas, my father croons off-key as we stroll through the supermarket. Shall we get some, he asks, a standing joke between us. My father hates bananas, peaches, plums, mangoes, anything mushy makes him shudder in disgust. Remember that time I baked you banana bread? I stopped our cart to ask. You loved it until I told you what it was, remember? Really? My father says, impossible. He backs away from the bananas as though they mean him harm. I don't remember. Sure you do, I insist. I put 3 pieces on a plate and you ate them all. It was the summer before I went off to college. My father steers clear of the bananas and pushes the cart towards the deli. Where'd you go to college again? He asks, placing a package of Rugelach into the cart. Vermont, I say, removing the Rugelach, which is bad for his diabetes. Don't you remember? We drove up and stopped for lunch at that diner in Montpelier, and the one woman working there was seating people, taking orders, cooking, running the register, and Mom felt so sorry for her, she offered to leap over the counter and lend a hand. Remember? At this, my father brightens. Ah, your mother, he says. She could have done it. She could do anything. Almost anything, I correct him. There was one thing she could never do. I reach for a bag of whole wheat bagels. What's that? My father asks, genuinely curious. She could never get you to eat a banana. That's true. My father's chortle dies in his throat. I would eat every banana in the world just to see her one more time, he says. And we both fall silent, make fists around the handle of our grocery cart, and together we push on.
Very, very tender conclusion, yes. I think that's full of good humor. And it isn't easy always to find the humor that can carry on throughout such a poem, but you have it coursing through that one, yes, we have no bananas. I think that is a real art there.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's not a lot of humor in my mom's book, but there's a lot of humor in my dad's book. And to me, my dad's illness was much more painful. So I think I had to temper these poems with humor just to really emotionally be able to get through them, to be able to write them.
Good point. That's clear. Well, have you got the next one? Heaven Can Rely on You?
Yes, I will read that and then go right into The First Time We Visit, because those are in order in the book itself. Heaven can rely on you, sings a chorus of strapping young men in sweet, deep voices that blend inside my father's head. Don't you hear them? He asks, then shrugs, unconcerned about being the sole witness to this tender serenade. He holds up a single finger, signaling, wait, wait. The men have stopped, but then they start up again. Gouda, 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 my father sings along. Like the cheese? I tease, trying to make light of this newest delusion. My father frowns, it isn't funny, and cocks his head like a puzzled puppy, trying to make sense of what's being said. The sound, any sound, a precious gift, since he doesn't hear much these days. Not the telephone's startled and startling shriek, not the blaring TV's blathering newscaster, not the neighborhood dog's insistent sharp bark, not the rain's hard hammer against the sliding glass door, and not a peep from the little boy who appears at the foot of his bed night after night, his eyes as blue as my father's before the cataracts flowed in, two puffy clouds across his morning sky. "Who is he, Dad?" I ask. My father shrugs, then lifts his finger again. "Yes, dear," he says. "I will, dear." He looks towards my mother's chair, and out of nowhere, I hear her too, her voice the weak whisper of that terrible last day. "Don't worry, sweetheart." She cupped my cheek with her worn, withered hand. "There's no problem so terrible that it can't get worse." "Gouda, gouda, gouda," sings my father happily off key, swaying in his seat, his ancient voice cracking like a young bar mitzvah boy's. "Needle, needle, needle, zuzza, zuzza, zuzza." The first time we visit the neurologist, he gives us exactly 7 minutes of his time. "What's 8 plus 15? He asks my father, who gives me a look I know all too well. "What is this guy, an imbecile?" 8 plus 15 is 23. My father speaks loudly, as if the doctor hears worse than he does. "Come on, ask me a real question." My father puts up his dukes and punches the air, eager for a good fight. 8 times 15 is 120. 120 times 15 is 1800. 1800 times 15 is 27,000. The poor neurologist has no way of knowing what a math whiz my father is, how he'd entertain us on long car rides by barking out math problems, or better yet, dare me to challenge him. "Hey, Dad, what's 11,327 plus 10,695? I'd ask. 22,022, he'd say in a second, waiting for me to work it out in my notebook. He was always right. "Hey, Dad, what's a million plus a trillion?" I'd ask, searching my brain for the biggest number in the universe. "A million trillion," he'd answer. "Hey, Dad, what's a million trillion plus a million trillion?" "A bazillion," he'd say, shaking his head so fast his cheeks turned to rubber and I'd crack up. If only we were laughing now. But the neurologist is not amused. He leans forward to study his puzzle of a patient. "Where were you born?" he asks. "Brooklyn, naturally," my father says, as if the doctor should know that anyone who was anyone was born in Brooklyn. "What did you do for a living?" My father sits up a little taller. "I'm an attorney, still practicing." The neurologist looks to me to confirm that either this is true or that my father has gone bananas. "Yep," I say, hoping to convey that this is a real problem. The neurologist does not catch on. "Who's running for president?" he asked my father, who is now convinced that the doctor is completely bonkers. "Hillary and that son of a bitch," he bellows, causing the two receptionists out front to break into peals of squealing laughter. "He's fine." The doctor leans back and glances up at the clock to let me know I've wasted enough of his time. "He's great. Take him home." My father is already out of his seat. "But what about his delusions?" I ask. "The men singing in his head, the little boy at the foot of his bed." The neurologist shrugs. "Old people have delusions," he says, pulling open his file cabinet's top drawer, clearly done with me and my father, who is already out in the waiting room, waving my coat by the shoulders like a matador taunting a bull, then hustling me down the hallway. "Come on, let's go, shake a leg." Clearly, we have more important things to do than deal with this nonsense. And this doctor, who I know my father thinks is a real nut job and will never again agree to see, not next week, not next month, not in a bazillion years.
I like the bringing the bazillion back at the very conclusion. Again, the wit of that kind of repetition is wonderful.
You know, that's the kind of moment as a poet when it occurs to you and you're like, yes, that's it. It's a thrill, right? It's just a thrill. Yes. when you know you've nailed the ending of a poem like that.
You know what that is going to do. Yes, right. So we'll proceed with a different style of verse form that's much sparer, than those that you've just read, but do you wish to follow that with My Handsome Elegant Father as a longer piece?
Well, I will start with It Was and then go right into My Handsome Elegant Father, since those right. poems are about the same incident.
Okay.
It was not a stroke of genius. It was not a stroke of luck. It was a stroke of misfortune that befell my father, leaving him crumpled at the foot of the driveway next to the garbage, waiting all morning to be picked up. My handsome, elegant father, in his freshly pressed gray wool suit, starched white shirt, easy on the collar, and cranberry juice colored tie, wearing the cufflink shaped like subway tokens I bought him for his birthday, and spit shiny black Italian leather shoes. Freshly showered, cleanly shaven, fingernails carefully clipped and buffed, smelling of ivory soap, Old Spice, Brill Cream, Listerine, and Arid Extra Dry, holding his monogrammed leather briefcase by the handle, off to work at 8 in the morning, returning at 7 in the evening, 6 days a week, 4 weeks a month, 12 months a year, for more than half a century, my handsome, elegant father, now dragging an IV pole through the hospital hallway, barefoot, grizzly-chinned, hair like Albert Einstein, sweaty and stinky, wearing a sky blue Johnny dotted with tiny tumbling teddy bears, the black flapping open, every string untied.
That's a quite full portrait in some respects of your father's way of preparing himself, and then sadly to describe the latter part of his life in the hospital. Very touching, very touching. Do you still remember these fragrances in your own mind?
Oh, I do. And actually, I took some of my father's handkerchiefs and I put some of these fragrances on them and put them in a sealed Ziploc baggie. And I take it out sometimes and smell it. And my dad comes right back to me.
The poetry of aromas, yes, how they can inspire and arouse memories. Without warning, my father is sprung.
Without warning, my father is sprung from the hospital early Friday evening, seeming no better yet no worse, according to the doctor, who dismisses him with an indifferent wave of his hand, a little too eager to get on with his weekend plans. My father refuses my offer of help and gets dressed in slow motion, then insists that I pack up a week's worth of newspapers, a half-empty box of tissues, a flimsy comb, a toothbrush, and a kidney-shaped pink plastic spittoon. Satisfied that he is leaving nothing behind, he smiles and waves like royalty as an aide pushes him past the nursing station, down the long hallway, into the groaning elevator and out to the parking lot. It's not until we drive halfway home and stop at a red light where a family of five crosses the street, father in gray suit with white sneakers gleaming on his feet, mother in long dark skirt, daughters all dolled up, subdued and somber, that I realize it's Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year. Good Yontif, I say to my father, pointing. He stares but does not wish me a good holiday in return. When we arrive home, he heads straight for the den and instantly falls asleep, a lazy boy in his lazy boy, hands clasped on his chest, thumbs twitching through his dreams. Darkness falls an hour later and he startles awake, looks around as if he has no idea where he is, sees me, sighs, says, God will forgive us, and dozes off again. I tuck a green and black afghan my mother knit 100 years ago under his chin as I remember sitting in synagogue with my father when I was a little girl. How I loved braiding the tzitzit of his talus, the white fringe so smooth and cool beneath my fingers, while the men all around me swayed and prayed, their deep voices ringing as much sweetness and sadness out of those ancient words as they could, that heart rendering Hebrew comforting me like a soft shawl wrapped around my small, slender shoulders. I stood when my father stood, bowed my head when my father bowed his head, sat when my father sat, his Amen, the sweetest and saddest of all. Last year, for the first time, we drove to services, my father unable to manage the 2-mile walk between home and shul. We sat up front, hoping that would help him hear, but after the third time he asked, "What page? What page?" licking his finger and frantically flipping through the prayer book like he was looking for an important number in an outdated phone book, I was relieved when his head dropped to his chin, then mortified once more when he began to snore so loudly the rabbi threw me a look and I took my father home. I know God will forgive my poor aged and aging father for not attending temple on this Day of Atonement. But I don't know if the same God will forgive me for not knowing what's best, to pray or not to pray, for the book of life to be inscribed at the start of the new year with my father's holy name underneath my own.
There you're really speaking about subtle warnings, although it says without warning. Subtle warnings that were appearing, mm-hmm. even though the hospital gives you a get out of here with a wave of the hand, you realize that you are now in a sort of ambivalent stage of your father's waning, and comes out quite prominently from the religious experience, again, the service that he attends and your complication there in tending to his comfort and his being able to feel the comfort he needs to continue being there. Very interesting poem about two kinds of institutions, the hospital and the temple.
I never thought of that, but that's absolutely true.
For as long as I can.
For as long as I can remember, my father has been a creature of habit. Every morning he rose at exactly 6 a.m., no need to set the clock, jumped into the shower, shaved, slapped his cheeks with cologne, donned a suit and tie, thudded down the stairs, punched in the code to shut the burglar alarm, yanked open the front door, hustled down the driveway, fetched the newspapers, clambered into the kitchen, sat at the head of the table, poured out a bowl of Special K, added 2% milk, filled his world's greatest dad mug with instant Maxwell House laced with Sweet and Low, skimmed the headlines of Newsday and the Times, gobbled up his cereal, gulped down his coffee, clattered his dirty dishes into the sink, threw on his overcoat, grabbed his leather briefcase, dashed out of the house, punched in the code to reset the burglar alarm, locked the front door, unlocked his Nissan Maxima, started her up, backed out and sped to the office, arriving before anyone else at exactly 7:45. My father thought this routine would last forever. Why wouldn't it? And cannot for the life of him fathom how quickly he went from husband to widower, attorney to retiree, tennis partner to spectator, driver to passenger, healthy to diabetic, hearing to practically deaf, seeing to practically blind. And if all that wasn't bad enough, now his beloved daughter, of all people, is trying to convince him to go from lifelong New Yorker to New Jerseyite, from proud homeowner to reluctant resident of what might as well be called God's waiting room. I don't like it. My father puckers up his face and whines like a little boy who has just been presented with a plate of liver and lima beans instead of a colorful brochure exalting the perks of downsizing, the benefits of independent living, and the joys of communal life. I don't like it either. This hurts me more than it hurts you, floats through my mind. But before I can stop myself, I make the calls, send for the paperwork, and lower the shades of the living room window so my father doesn't have to see the green for sale sign blooming on his lawn.
Quite a complete portrait you put in that one. Habits
yes.
of the day, and yet again coming around to that decline, that terrible departure that you don't want to admit is a reality, but is there in all the signs, right?
Yeah. Well, my father was absolutely a creature of habit. He liked his routine. He did not like to stray from it in the least. So I wanted to really capture who he was in his full glory, you know, as well as portraying him in his decline, because I knew him both ways, of course, and for much more time as the spectacular father, lawyer, husband, man he was before he became incapable of really being his full self.
Yes. So we're now coming close to the end of your veil of tears that really is getting more grievous as we proceed. I hope you have good strength in reading these, Leslia.
It takes a long time to die, says my father, who is sick and tired of everyone telling him how great he looks. He's almost 90 with a full head of hair and a full set of teeth, and he has kept his girlish figure, of which he has always been immensely proud. Everyone says I look like I'm 60, he gloats. Dad, I'm 60, I remind him. He scrunches up his nose, shakes his head, and flicks his fingers twice, dismissing my words, which can't possibly be true. How can he be old enough to have a 60-year-old daughter? The women are beating down my door, he brags, before rousing himself off his rocker to gather a fistful of notes strewn about the living room. He fanned them across his cluttered coffee table. Pick a card, any card, I think, as I read invitations from Doris, Sylvia, Gladys, Marlene, asking him to play bingo, Scrabble, Monopoly, Risk. Dear Mr. N, howdy, new neighbor, from one New Yorker to another. In pristine printing, scribbled script, pen, pencil, even pink ink, the ladies invite my fetching father to take a walk, watch a film, share a meal, drink some tea. So what do you think? I ask him, neatly stacking the notes into a pile on the table next to a teetering tower of junk mail, asking my father for money, besides a mountain of unread law journals and other magazines. My father flicks his fingers again and gives a little snort, as if he can't be bothered. The thought of being with a woman other than your mother is repulsive to me, he says stiffly, as though he has rehearsed it. So, can I throw these away? I ask, always eager to straighten up his new apartment, a Sisyphean task. Leave them, says my father, the original pack rat, who has stashed beneath his bed several shoeboxes of birthday cards and anniversary cards collected over 60 plus years, each one signed by my mother, always and forever. Why do you want them? I ask my father, who shrugs, his new answer to everything. I'll take care of them later, he promises, which we both know means they will remain right here where I drop them on his coffee table, next to a cigar box full of family photos, an empty bottle of baby aspirin, a cup of tea grown cold, always and forever. I wish my father a very happy birthday and yell in his ear, Dad, can you believe you're 90? He backs out of my hug, tilts his head to one side and peers at me intently, trying to figure out if what I'm saying is true. Then he collapses onto a kitchen chair as if the weight of every day of those 90 years is pressing down on him hard. Got any words of wisdom, Dad? I try to lighten the mood. He sighs deeply, shakes his head vigorously, and then begins to speak. My mother died at 80, my brother at 50, my sister at 35. I don't know when my father died. Maybe he never did. He'd be 127 now, the old bastard, and it would serve him right. I haven't seen him since 1939 when he went out for a pack of cigarettes and never came back. I was 12 and went right to work shining shoes for a penny, selling newspapers for a nickel. Later, I went to CCNY and became a CPA. I was always a numbers man, but never thought I'd make it to 90. In my day, no one lived to be 90. Who would want to? Certainly not me. But here I am. Blood pressure 120 over 80, pulse 60, all 32 teeth still in my mouth. How did I get to be so unlucky? I was supposed to drop dead at my desk when I was 75, maybe 80, and leave your mother $1 million. Who knew her days were numbered? 40, 4 years more, and then poof, abracadabra, she was gone. That was some lousy trick, her disappearing act. How could she leave me to my lonesome, to carry on without her for 4 years, 8 months, 3 weeks, 6 days? He looks at his watch, 19 hours, 27 minutes and 32 seconds. But hey, he shrugs, who's counting?
A man of numbers. He was certainly a good-looking father, even at his 90 years old, if the imagery I've seen in your website, in the parts of the book that you sent me, that's true. These are late photos of him with you, aren't they?
Oh, yes. He was always very good-looking. Till the day he died, he always dressed very elegantly. He was very reluctant to give up his suits, you know. So when he first moved into independent living, he was still dressing, you know, as if he was going to work, very formally. But then, as the months went on, he dressed less formally. But he was always took great pride in his appearance.
In the interest of time, we should get to my mother at the bridge table, which is, I think, a very fit conclusion for the poems you chose.
I'll just say that my father, when I asked him what he felt about independent living, he said, I'll give it a year. And he died very shortly before his 1 year anniversary of moving there. So he was a man of his word. And now I will read the last poem in the book. My mother is at the bridge table with Loretta, Gert, and Pearl when my father finds his way to heaven. Sit down, dear, she says, patting the seat beside her and barely looking up from the hand she's been dealt. The game is almost through. But my father is too overcome to sit. He stands and stares at his beloved, free of wheelchair and oxygen tank, happily puffing away on a Chesterfield King held between two perfectly manicured fingers, sipping a cup of instant Maxwell House, leaving a pair of bright red lip prints on the white china cup, her hair, the lovely chestnut brown it was the day they met, her face free of worry lines, the diamond pendant he bought her on their first trip to Europe, glittering against her ivory throat. She looks like the star of an old black and white movie who would never give him the time of day, but somehow spent 63 years by his side. I missed you, my father tells my mother, leaning down to kiss her offered cheek. Of course you did, says my mother, who always knows everything. She plays her cards right, and after Loretta and Pearl and Gert fold, she stands to let my father take her in his arms, and in their heavenly bodies, they dance.
Very moving conclusion. And the work of poetry, I Wish My Father by Leslie Newman. I hope you have enjoyed hearing a rich selection of highly emotional poetry, poetry of grief and love, honor, service. And we can't thank you enough, Leslie, for being with us a second time. I hope that we can ask you to do another half hour of your lovely poems.
It would be a pleasure.
Thank you very much. This is Sound Poetry. I have been your host, David Gilmore, with Leslie and Newman.